From NPR and the Futuro Media Group, it's Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa, and this week, Larger Than Life. People who represent so much more than themselves. We meet a woman who fought alongside Cesar Chavez for the rights of others.
We did this for our people. If we hadn't done it, we would still have the slavery of before.
And we learn about the cult of Hugo Chavez in Venezuela.
Dice Chavez, ya tú no eres Chavez. Tú eres un pueblo. Chavez se hizo pueblo.
And an extended interview with legendary Latina actress and larger-than-life persona, Rita Moreno. All this plus La Santa Cecilia coming up on Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. No se vayan. Stay with us. Welcome to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. For many Latinos, the first person they saw in mainstream American culture who looked like them was actress Rita Moreno. Between her role in West Side Story and her time as a cast member on The Electric Company, she was a representative for more than one generation. When I first saw West Side Story, it was a complete revelation. For a little Mexican girl in Chicago, a movie with a beautiful girl named Maria was life-changing, even if she was played by Natalie Wood. But Rita Moreno stole the movie with her portrayal of Anita, and she became the first Latina to ever win an Academy Award for that performance. So today, as we talk about being larger than life, we're thrilled to bring you an extended interview with Rita Moreno, who joined us in our studios in Harlem. You know, Rita, I have met you on other occasions, but honestly, to have you sitting down with me for a full
interview.
Because we've been trying to do this for a while.
Oh, about 10 years. So I'm delighted to be here.
In your trajectory, and as you say, you have been now receiving many Lifetime Achievement Awards.
I was saying it's become a cottage industry.
But you are pretty amazing. I mean, you have an extraordinary career as an American actress. So we want to applaud you. I mean, that's a wonderful thing, no?
Oh, yes. No, I'm not complaining. It's just that I think of myself in such a different way than you would think an actor thinks of himself. I'm still that little Puerto Rican girl. It's true. When something really major like this happens, I really literally go right back to Puerto Rico and being on the boat and coming to this country with my mom. It's really difficult for me to see myself in the position of this person that they're honoring.
Still?
Absolutely. Absolutely.
What is it about Latinas? Because we kind of do this thing, which is just like, you know, we're like, me? Really? What?
Me? It's true. I mean, my daughter is always amazed when I'm amazed. She says, well, why not, Mom? And I said, well, I suppose. But it's always a reluctant kind of acceptance. I guess, you know, I think you get traumatized in a way. You are so accustomed to being ignored and let's say, treated in an undignified way. That's the thing that always stays with you. I don't know why. I mean, I've had a remarkable life being honored and recognized and acknowledged for a life. That's staggering. I mean, come on. Let's be honest. Wouldn't you be staggered?
I think I would be staggered. But what's staggering to me is the fact that the place that you go back to is the boat. And when I was reading about you and the fact that you have written about that boat ride. I mean, most people think New York, I mean, Puerto Rico, New York, you were on a plane. You were on a boat.
I was on a ship called the SS Carabobo, which is hilarious.
You're kidding me, Carabobo.
No, that's what's so funny. If you read the book, it'll say, you know, Carabobo. Well, Carabobo literally means stupid face, dumb face. And for, you know, I think that's not a good portent for what's to come in this new life I'm supposed to have. Why in God's name would anyone name a ship Stupid Face?
Well, you laugh about it now, but the way you write about it, because you write in such detail about how harrowing it was. So describe for
the
our
trip.
Listeners. Yeah, what was this trip from Puerto Rico where you had this idyllic childhood, you know, literally that idyllic, like jumping around in the jungle with the frogs and the butterflies,
literally.
And then you get on this ship.
And I get on this ship, and there's a horrendous storm at sea. As I like to say, you know, Puerto Ricans are known for many things. You know, their vivacity, their capacity for joy, their musical sense. But I think the thing for which we take the greatest honor is panicking. I mean, you have Puerto Ricans who can't swim because, you know, nobody swims in Puerto Rico. That's for the tourists or the people who, you know, do special fishing things. But nobody swims there. So here you have all of these Puerto Ricans going bananas because the ship is behaving like a cork at sea and getting sick to their stomachs and all that kind of stuff. Ay, Dios mío, me voy a morir.
You remember.
I remember.
It's like you remember hearing those voices, those screams.
I remember the screams. I hear. I remember people weeping and wailing and being ill. I mean, a lot of people got very, very sick on that trip. And, you know, cursing the day they ever thought that they should go to this so-called wonderful new life. So it's very vivid in my memory.
And the fact
I can't remember where I put my keys yesterday, but man, I have a very detailed memory of Puerto Rico and my life in Puerto Rico and on the boat, on the ship.
So why do you think that we go to this place? Because you said that after that Latinas, speaking about our identity, that we are so accustomed to being set aside or overlooked or treated badly.
Success is a lot more accessible now. It was almost impossible then and almost laughable that you would even try then. So I think that, that's a part of my youth that has stayed with me. It's very stubborn and it stays there.
So is the part of the youth that stays with you the part that says, there's not a place for me here, but I'm going to try anyway because I've got this thing in my gut?
Absolutely. For sure, for sure. And, you know, also to this day, and I have a feeling this happens with a lot of people, they just don't know how to deal with it or what to name it. I call it the negative little child in me who still says, by the way, ha ha, I knew you couldn't do it. I knew, really, she exists in me. This is Rosita Dolores. That's me as a child saying, this is not going to happen. Are you serious? You don't deserve this. You haven't earned this. That's still very much there. The way in which I deal with this this bad kid in me is to send her to her room. You know, say, go to your room.
Y te callas la boca.
And shut up. Shut up in your face, as my mom would say. But she does exist in me, and I think she exists that kind of presence exists in a lot of people. They just don't. They just think it's a part of them that's much a part of the conscious mind. I don't think it's conscious at all. I think it comes from another place and another time. And she hangs around. I mean, I did a play about my life, Life Without Makeup, and I had a real crisis of confidence before we opened. I mean, I couldn't remember any lines. I couldn't say them properly. It was really bad, really, really bad and scary to everyone in the production. And the artistic director of the theater came over to my house and he says, okay, what's going on? You know, what's happening? And I immediately burst into tears and I said, I don't know. And he says, no, we have to examine this because if we don't find out what's happening here, you're not going to get to opening night in one piece. And I'm sobbing and carrying on. He says, what is it? Are you afraid of something? And I said, I think so. And this is all between sobs. And then he says to me, well, what? And it finally occurred to me. I said, I'm afraid I'm going to disappoint, between sobs. And he looked at me like I was a crazy woman, because he thinks I'm one of the most talented women on earth. And he nearly fell off his chair. He says, you're afraid you're going to disappoint? I said, yes. And then I really started to cry. That weird lack of confidence that's brought on by this dark presence, who definitely, obviously, still exists in my persona. Amazing, isn't it? Because everybody thinks of me as a person who's so strong. Well, I am, but not necessarily in that way.
You've written about the fact that there are two things that come to play. The fact that you're Latina, the fact that you're Puerto Rican, the fact that you weren't white, and the fact that you were a woman.
Mm-hmm.
So is it, which one is it? Or is it, or are they, or I is Rosita,
they're
all
the same,
like,
thing.
They're the same thing.
Yeah. It's Rosita Dolores Alberio. And I have a feeling, I was a very sensitive child. I can say all of this now in retrospect, because I didn't know this for years about myself. And I was in therapy for years, and a very successful therapy, I feel. But I never felt confident about myself. Now, that came from my mother, too, because she was a typical ghetto mom in the sense that, oh, hey, don't make waves. You know, be nice. You have to be a good girl. You always have to be a good girl. And if you're a very sensitive child, as I was, that stays with you for a very long time. Don't make waves. Don't have opinions. You just smile and use your cute self to charm everybody. And I was that. I was all of that for far too many years, which is what sent me into therapy eventually.
So how old were you when you went into therapy?
I was in my early 20s, and it was Marlon Brando who said, you need help. Marlon Brando's telling me I need help, right?
You're one of the few people who has
this
that.
this lunatic colossus. But he was right. He had seen me on television one day doing a local show, just being me, and he said, that's not you at all. I didn't know who you were. He said, you need to find out who you are. And he's the guy, really, who ultimately helped me find myself, despite this horrendous relationship that we had.
Never know how much I love.
After the break, we hear more from Rita Moreno about her relationship with Marlon Brando, and more importantly, with her self-doubt. Part two of my interview with Rita Moreno is up next. But first, we want to mention someone who the Oscars forgot this season. Missing from this year's In Memoriam segment was actress and singer Sara Montiel. Montiel arrived in Hollywood in the 1950s after finding film success in Mexico and her native Spain. She starred alongside Gary Cooper and Burt Lancaster in the film Veracruz. Later, she moved into music and TV and was a beloved and highly paid figure in Spain throughout her life. She died last year at her home in Madrid at the age of 85. Next time, no te olvides, Oscar. And coming up later on Latino USA, one woman shot for standing up for workers' rights alongside Cesar Chavez.
Que me entró y me salió acá. Ay. Y luego este me entró aquí y me salió. Aquí. Y acá tengo el otro.
Stay with us. No se vayan.
Ponte bien buena, que no te dé pena. Es luna llena, yo te pago la cena. Mujer, disculpa, no te quiero ofender. Coger el micrófono porque ese es mi deber. Usa las garras del perfume que compré. Chécate qué chilo el spot que encontré. Me acordé que eres bien difícil, pero fácil. Resulta que yo soy más ágil. Dile a tu mamá que no vas a llegar. No hay pedo con tu hermano porque ya sabe qué onda. Con tu papá, chale, mejor ni me meto. Supe que tu ex por poco queda muerto. Vámonos viendo, yo tengo más ventaja. Que yo sí trabajo, él no trabaja. Ándale, se nos hace tarde. Luego no me digas que tardas bastante. No me tomes de la mano, soy un amigo tuyo muy lejano. Ten las llaves, tú manejas el carro, pero antes apaga el cigarro. Bien, soy como tu primo en
Welcome back to Your Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. There's a very small, very special club among award winners in the arts. It's called EGOT. It's an acronym for winning the Emmy, the Grammy, the Oscar, and the Tony. And only 12 people have ever achieved this feat. We take you back to my conversation with the one and only Rita Moreno. Before the break, we'd been discussing her relationship with Marlon Brando.
Well, no, I mean, the fact that you can talk about a relationship with Marlon Brando when Marlon Brando was Marlon Brando is still a little jaw-dropping, you know.
He was jaw-dropping. He was gorgeous. He was powerful. He was handsome. He looked like a Roman coin, for Pete's sake.
He really did.
Yeah, he
when
did.
I think of those photographs.
And he was one, at that point, he was one of the brightest, most intelligent, most well-informed people, men, I'd ever met in my life. So there was a lot to attract me, aside from the usual, you know, animal magnetism that occurred with him. But also, I was very young for my age, always was. And I really believed in romance, which was, you know, a big mistake. I was very Latina. I was mad about him, but I was also, to be very honest, mad about the power that came with being with him. When I was with Marlon Brando, I was somebody. And that really, really screwed up that relationship, aside from the fact that he was, you know, truly a very complicated, crazy neurotic man. I found myself being somebody only when I was with him. We've heard that before, haven't we, with other things, with other women?
We have. You write about when you were in Hollywood, the fact that you would look at the other starlets and you would say, I'm the wrong color. You actually would look at them and just say, there's something wrong with my skin color?
Absolutely. I absolutely believed that I always saw myself as darker than I was, for instance. And the crazy thing is that all I could see was fairness and blue eyes and how easy it was for them, or so it seemed. You know, the fact that probably they were just as neurotic as I in their own way is beside the point. I didn't perceive it that way. But you also have to remember that when I was a child, I had terrible confrontations with the other kids who called me terrible names. From the time I couldn't even speak English, and kids were calling me sick. But even when I didn't speak English and they said names like that at me, I knew something was wrong with me, even though I didn't know English, because it happened so often. I was five. I was six. I was in kindergarten. And right away, I knew that something was wrong with me. And of course, I never told my mom about this. I never told her about other episodes in my young life when kids were calling me terrible names. That's something I never brought home because I really felt that it would hurt her so much and that she couldn't, there was nothing she could do about it. Nothing I could do about it.
It wasn't the American dream that she was hoping for.
Hell no. Absolutely not. Now, here's what happened after West Side Story, which was so touching to me. Do you remember Liz Torres? Who was a...
Of course I know Liz Torres.
Yeah. She's a wonderful, wonderful woman. She said, I have to tell you a story about Oscar night when you won the award. And she said, you know, as you know, as a Latina, you know that the barrio is a very raucous place. We yell and talk and we laugh very loud, which is true. That's me. I am a raucous Latina. I cry hard. I laugh hard. It's all very, very emotional. So she said, on Oscar night, as usual, see, the windows were all open because it was a hot night in El Barrio. And she said, you could see here, all of the TV sets were on for the Oscars because obviously one of us was maybe going to win or maybe not, but she was going to be announced. And she said, it was noisy until Rock Hudson went on for the best featured supporting actress. And she said that entire neighborhood turned to dead silence. She says she remembers thinking, wow, they're really paying attention. And when Rock Hudson announced my name, there was such screaming and yelling going to the windows, which were open anyway, and she did it. Coño, se la comió. Whoa, she did it, she did it. And I started to cry when she told me the story. And I said to Liz, you know what they were really saying? We did it. We did it. And that inspired a lot of people who are now, you know, rather big stars. I know that Jennifer Lopez is certainly one of them, Rosie Perez. Because now I'm known as La Pionera, which still makes me laugh because I don't see myself that way.
As a pioneer, really?
Well,
my gosh, you were a pioneer.
You know what? I get ultra modest, and I always get very I get shy when people say things like that to me. And yes, they do say things like that. And yes, I do immensely appreciate their telling me that. The last one was Kerry Washington. Kerry Washington, who I met recently, this beautiful young woman, and she grabbed me and hugged me, and she says, you have no idea how much you mean to me. And I'm looking at her, you know, with these huge eyes. I'm suddenly, you know, 10 years old again. And I'm saying, you do? And she said, of course I do. What do you mean, do? She said, absolutely. She said, you mean? And she went on and on about you inspired me and all that. I met Amy Poehler at the same thing. Amy Poehler, who says, oh, my God, I love you. And I'm staring at her saying, you love me? She said, of course I love you. You're wonderful. It absolutely takes me by the most profound surprise.
So does all of this make you feel like the weight of history, responsibility, you've got to do the right thing?
No. Absolutely not. I do what I need to do. And I don't feel that because I have become the role model where I didn't have one. But because of that doesn't mean that I'm going to change my opinion about how I feel about W or the immigration situation. Not at all.
Which actually, as a Puerto Rican woman, you know, you never had to deal with immigration issues. And yet you're the one who's bringing it up and saying that it is a...
Well, listen, it's still part of me. It's part of my history. It doesn't matter that that didn't happen to me. My community is me. I am my community.
And in terms of immigration, what do you see that's happening in your community?
I know I see one thing that is terrific, and that is that the community is really becoming vocal, has become vocal about it, where we didn't for many, many, many years. It was just somehow accepted. We just didn't feel we had the strength. And I remember thinking that when the Black community began to, you know, just speak out, and I thought, why isn't that not happening with us? Isn't that interesting? And I thought, yes, we have part of us has Cesar Chavez, but somehow it doesn't translate to the rest of us. What is happening? Why aren't we doing this? And then one day it just happened. Somebody just said, I've had enough. I have value and I have worth, and I'm going to do my best to see to it that we get that kind of recognition and acknowledgement and respect. And it's wonderful to see. It's great to see. Now, let's hope that there is genuine reform, not out of the side of the mouth reform.
And that's really what you want to hand down to the next generation, right? Which is...
Absolutely.
No matter how it looks on the outside, most people on the inside are terrified, and you just got to...
It's one of the reasons I wrote this book, because when people start talking about the Marlon Brando part of it and the Elvis Presley part of it and call it juicy... I think what they miss is that I felt it was very important. He played a huge part in my life, a huge part. He changed my life in so many ways, most for the worse, but some for the better. And I can't not do my life without including him. It's a huge part of 8 years, on and off, the tempestuous, obsessive relationship. And I deliberately wrote that as honestly as I could because I wanted women to understand that they are not alone. That I, too, like many others, wanted to please this one man and would do anything for him. And that one can somehow get over this. It was very important to me to talk to the woman who's reading this. And it saddens me that people think it's just, you know, meant to be juicy. It was even the Elvis Presley part, which is kind of hilarious because I wanted to make Marlon jealous and Elvis wanted to meet me. So what better guy? Two kings.
Oh, God. That's just like crazy.
It is. It's bizarre. that's why that's mentioned. I went into great detail about Marla for that reason.
I have always seen you as just incredibly positive and definitely one of the women who I would say is the queen of never giving up.
Well, that's why I wrote the book, too, though. I wanted to let people know it's never quite the way it looks. Never, ever. And that it happens to the best of us and to the worst of us. And I wanted them to take heart from that, that too can pass.
Rita Moreno, do you sleep well at night?
You bet your ass, yes. Thank you. Thank you. I'm sure they'll censor me, but...
Thank you, Rita, for coming and visiting us in Harlem and for making one of my childhood dreams come true. Rita Moreno is 82 years old. She's won the Emmy, the Grammy, the Oscar, and the Tony, and most recently, the Lifetime Achievement Award from the Screen Actors Guild. Her next project is a TV pilot written by Amy Poehler called Old Soul. Be sure to check out her new book, Rita Moreno, a memoir. To see pictures of her over the years, visit our website, latinousa.org. Cesar Chavez, the co-founder of the United Farm Workers, is something of a national icon. There's even a U.S. postage stamp with his image. Many close to Chavez say that when he was alive, he often turned down honors because he knew that the success of the farm worker movement was built on the tenacity and courage of people whose names might not ever make the history books. People like Josefina Flores. Reporter Farida Javala Romero visited the now 83-year-old Flores at her home in Delano, California, the place where the UFW's grape strike began.
Josefina Flores began working in the fields when she was 8. She never went to school. She was born a U.S. citizen in California, but wasn't treated that way. We were treated like animals, she says, like we were nobodies. The bosses just wanted to make money. If you got sick and fainted there in the field, they wouldn't call an ambulance. It was the 1930s. Farm workers used a short hoe that caused terrible back pain. They drank tepid water out of a bucket only when they reached the end of a row. They didn't have the right to shade or breaks, let alone minimum wage. There were no restrooms. When women had to relieve themselves, they'd stand in a circle around each other right there in the fields. But the worst, Josefina says, was the rape. We were young then, she says. Sometimes one of the girls would come and say, the foreman said that if I didn't have sex with him, that he would fire me and my family. By the 1960s, not much had changed. So when Josefina heard about a man named Cesar Chavez, who was organizing to change things, she went to hear him speak. Chavez said something that gave her hope and strength. He said we had to make a sacrifice, to do something to defend ourselves, because if not, this would never end, says Josefina. And everyone who joined the movement had to commit to nonviolence to keep the moral high ground. A lot of farm workers thought Chavez was crazy and that real change could never happen because other efforts had failed in the past. But still, dreamers like Josefina joined the union and helped each other. That's where she learned how to read and write.
Yo aprendí en la unión.
In 1965, the first strike against grape growers began in the town of Delano. In 1966, Cesar Chavez and farm workers walked some 300 miles to the state capital in Sacramento. In 1967, they launched a long boycott of California table grapes. Josefina would wake up at 3 a.m. for a day of picket lines and strikes. She'd carry a banner of the Virgen de Guadalupe at the front of the line. She and others survived on food donations and often went hungry. They slept on the floor for months at a time. Sometimes, they were beaten up by thugs hired by the growers.
Llegaban ellos con unos carrotes ahí como y se bajaban y se bajaban golpeándonos.
They came with clubs, got out of their cars, and started beating us, says Josefina. What will you do? You couldn't even run because they were big men. You should have seen them. They would run, grab us, and beat us.
You have to remember the times.
Mark Grossman was Cesar Chavez's speechwriter and aide at the UFW.
Farm workers had no right to organize. None of the social protective legislation that industrial workers had won in the 1930s.
It's the summer of 1973 in a grape field near Delano. Sheriff's deputies hold batons and advance towards a peaceful crowd. Some people lie motionless, face down on the dusty road, while others are bloody and handcuffed. Here's Cesar Chavez.
We've had now a series of beatings by the police. They have very consistently used profanity against men and women in the picket line in such language and in such a way as to tell them that directly that they're going to kill them and that they're no good son of a and that they're Mexican.
In many ways, in the 60s and 70s, rural California was not all that different from Alabama and Mississippi.
Mark Grossman.
There have been five farm workers who were martyred, who lost their lives during strikes, and thousands more who were unjustly incarcerated, or hundreds who were beaten, and dozens who were shot. And yet, through all of that, the farm workers, people like Josefina, maintained their commitment to nonviolence.
Josefina herself was a target of an assassination attempt. She says she was shot seven times after leaving a picket line to get food for the strikers. Not all of her contemporaries in the UFW confirm her story, but she rolls up her sleeve and shows me six scars. She says they're from three gunshots that went straight through her left arm.
Que me entró y me salió acá. Ay. Y luego este me entró aquí y me salió aquí. Y acá tengo el otro.
By 1975, 17 million Americans were boycotting grapes. Finally, the growers agreed to a state law guaranteeing farm workers in California the right to organize. The UFW negotiated contracts for its members with health benefits and paid vacations. Grossman says Chavez gave people hope and faith in themselves.
They believed that the work they were doing was going to make a difference for themselves and for their families, and it did. And I think Josefina is the epitome of that transformation in human beings that the farm worker movement produced.
Today, Josefina lives by herself in a small, cozy home in Delano. Her walls are covered with photos, mementos of half a century of activism. There are images of Pope John Paul II, the Reverend Martin Luther King, and of course, Cesar Chavez.
Hicimos todo esto por nuestra gente. Si no lo hubiéramos hecho, mijita, todavía estuviera la esclavitud de antes.
We did this for our people, Josefina says. If we hadn't done it, we would still have the slavery of before.
Tienen sus excusados, ya tienen el agua, ya se enferma alguien y le hablan a la ambulancia.
Now farm workers have bathrooms. They have water, Josefina says. If someone gets sick, they call an ambulance. But that was because of Cesar Chavez and all the strikers like me who are old now. We never forget what we did and what happened to us. There's more to do. Nationally, farm workers still do not have the right to a minimum wage. There are still heat-related deaths. Just 3 years ago, Josefina walked as part of a 150-mile march.
Yo no dejo, yo ahí estoy. Solamente que esté enfermo, que de a tiro no pueda moverme, no voy.
As long as she can move, Josefina says, she'll be there for the farm workers. For Latino USA, this is Farida Yabala Romero in Delano, California.
Coming up on Latino USA.
I just thought it was time. I saw so many activists as well putting themselves out there, and that's what kind of like made me not be as fearful.
A Grammy-winning band inspired by the undocumented. Stay with us. No se vayan.
Is it getting better? Or do you feel the same?
I like the island Manhattan.
I know you do.
Smoke on your pipe and put let it
out of here.
I like to be in America. Okay, by me in America. Everything free in America.
For a smoke. In America.
Okay. Buying on credit is so nice.
One look at us and they charge twice.
I have my own washing machine.
What will you have though to keep clean?
Skyscrapers bloom in America. Cadillac bloom in America. Industry boom in America.
12 in a room in America.
New housing with more space.
Welcome back to Latino USA. I'm Maria Hinojosa. A handful of Venezuelans are planning a protest at a trade union building in Manhattan. This protest in New York is a commemoration to Hugo Chavez himself.
Chavez to reclaim socialism as a another kind of system. The Bolivarian Revolution means the Latin American integration in some kind of socialist framework.
That's activist William Camacaro. Chavistas in and outside of Venezuela are preparing events and rallies in memory of Hugo Chavez 1 year after he died of cancer. Chavez was elected to power in 1999. He unified the Venezuelan left around him, drafted a new constitution, and stayed in power, winning 4 elections in 15 years.
Chavez, ya tú no eres Chavez. Tú eres un pueblo. Chavez se hizo pueblo.
Chavez is not Chavez. Chavez is the Venezuelan people. Talk about larger than life. That was Hugo Chavez in 2012. He reduced poverty and inequality in a country fed up with its corrupted elite. He supported leaders and international organizations that either opposed or ignored the United States, or, as he called it, El Imperio. His leadership style was divisive.
When Chavez came into power, we were only 4 or 5 years old. So that's the only thing we know. And it does not leave a legacy of democracy.
Maria Josefa Mendoza is a Venezuelan student leader in Washington, D.C. Many Venezuelan students like her will not be celebrating Chavez's legacy this week. He dismissed political opponents as fascists, and he was hostile to privately owned media in Venezuela. Chavez even attempted a failed military coup in 1992. New York University history professor Alejandro Velasco explains.
I think that it is accurate to say that there was an authoritarian strand in Chavez and Chavismo that had in part to do with a military background that seeks to impose rather than to negotiate.
Then Chavez himself suffered a failed coup by the opposition in 2002.
It's a mutually nurturing authoritarianism.
Chavez's overwhelming popularity came from a combination of things his successor, Nicolas Maduro, just doesn't have.
Charisma, high oil prices, and the socioeconomic conditions for a political base.
Nostalgic Chavistas still think back to Chavez's trademark baritone, like this hymn he improvised in one of his last TV appearances. Hugo Chavez died exactly a year ago this week. The commemoration of his death comes in the third week of violent protests against the government of his successor, Nicolas Maduro. Girish Gupta is a foreign reporter based in Caracas who's been covering the situation in Venezuela. Girish, thank you so much for joining us on Latino USA.
Thank you.
So, Girish, it's 1 year after Hugo Chavez's death. Can you tell us what the mood is like on the ground today going into the third week of protests and how much this event is playing into the feeling on the ground?
The mood is very defiant. People are going to stay out on the streets. However, what Maduro will want to do is use the anniversary of Chavez's death to bring back the memory of Hugo Chavez and remind people why they did support him.
Is that what you're seeing is essentially not a ramping down, but rather a ramping up of opposition tactics in these communities that are saying they want the Maduro government to disappear?
Yeah, like you say, we're seeing lots of these barricades with trash, debris. And then across the country, we're seeing that same thing, but in much more force. People are really up for staying in the streets. And it's not just the middle classes, it's the poor.
How much support does Maduro still have in Venezuela? And are the Chavistas still with him?
They are not as supportive of Maduro now after a year. And Chavistas have said to me, although they're not necessarily out on the streets protesting with the opposition, they've said, you know, that they're not so keen on Maduro. Now, that won't manifest itself during the celebrations, of course, for the anniversary of Hugo Chavez's death. We expect seas of red across the country as organized by the government and as the government are so good at doing here.
We've also heard reports that are very confusing about what the government is doing vis-a-vis journalists. How hard is it for journalists to be working independently on the ground?
It's not some hardline Cuba or North Korea type policy that they have. But as you said, there's been a couple of TV networks that have experienced trouble. And we have had some foreign reporters who've been roughed up a little bit on the streets by the National Guard and even detained. The government is, I think, being quite smart about this. They don't want to clamp down in a blanket way, but yeah, it is difficult for people to get information. People in Caracas don't really know what's happening in, say, Tátira, where things are much stronger. They can rely on social media, Twitter, YouTube and so on, but that doesn't really give an honest and verifiable account of what's going on.
So opposition leaders are calling for the Maduro government to step down. That's their hardline position. What alternatives are there at this point to solve the crisis?
Electorally, there's no way for the opposition to take power unless, of course, Maduro decides to stand down. They have the opportunity of a referendum in 2 years. For a lot of people on the streets, that's a long way away. People are talking about a coup on the streets. People want a coup, but it's very difficult to see that anything has been organized or decided to that end.
Girish, do you have any idea the possible role that the United States might play in this?
Well, that's right. On the streets, especially in the opposition camps, yes, people are wanting the US to get involved, and critics of the US in the government obviously suspect that the US is involved, and diplomats have been kicked out recently, as has happened so many times over the years. I don't think necessarily is too interested in what happens here, because despite all the rhetoric, the relationship between Washington and Caracas is very good. The oil is still flowing.
Thank you so much for all your work on the ground, Girish. We appreciate it.
Thank you.
Girish Gupta is a freelance journalist based in Caracas. He's reported on Venezuela for the BBC, Al Jazeera, and NPR.
Okay, and the winner is 30 Días, La Santa Cecilia.
The Los Angeles band La Santa Cecilia had just finished performing at this year's Grammy Awards when they were called back on stage to accept the Grammy for Best Latin or Alternative Album and to send this message.
Thank you so much. We're proud to be children of immigrant parents, and we dedicate this award to the more than 11 million undocumented people that live and work really hard in this country.
One of those undocumented immigrants was standing right on stage. The band's accordion player and co-founder, Pepe Carlos, who came with his family to the U.S. from Mexico when he was a child. Reporter Valerie Hamilton talked to the band about the ways his immigration status has given them extra responsibility as well as extra inspiration.
My name is Marisol Hernandez. I'm the singer for La Santa Cecilia.
My name is Miguel and I play percussion.
Hi, my name is Alex and I'm the bass player of La Santa Cecilia.
My name is Pepe Carlos, and I play accordion and requinto.
My parents immigrated to the U.S. when I was 6 years old. I am undocumented. I went to school here. This is where I live. This is LA's my home.
I mean, I've known Pepe since we were around 16 years old, so I always knew about him, you know, and his struggle.
I went to school, studied a two-year program of architecture. I was laid off as a designer. I went to apply for a different job. The guy said, I need to see a social security card. And I told him, you know what? I'm undocumented. He said, you know what? I can't hire you. I went home that day, really bummed out because of the situation. So from that point on, I decided to go into the music business, thinking that I wasn't going to need any papers, and that was also one of my passions in life. A few months after, we started La Santa Cecilia.
Cuando la negra te invite a bailar, no le digas no. Cuando la negra te invite a bailar, no le digas no.
You know, we started playing in the city, the band started growing, and we finally got invited to play at South by Southwest. You know, we were all like looking forward to fulfilling our dreams, to traveling and stuff.
But we were afraid that when we were going to go to Texas at some point, at some checkpoint, we would get stopped.
Right when we got into Arizona, we got pulled over. And we were like, oh man, like, what are we gonna do? You know, like, to ask us for our papers. And then what we would do was just say, like, everyone would just be like, well, we didn't bring papers. We just have our driver's license and we're American citizens. Like, what's the big deal, you know?
Everyone in the band has been afraid that I can get deported.
We just kind of got used to taking these detours, no? Of taking, like, really long roads, no? To avoid checkpoints and immigration checkpoints and things like that.
We would drive for about 30 hours just to get to Texas. Like, especially when we hit that 24-hour mark, they were always reminding me, hey, Pepe, can we ask the label to help you out? Can I ask my sister to help you out?
It scared us, you know?
I mean, I just remember the time when we got offered to go to Mexico, you know? And then we couldn't take Pepe, who was like the main instrument in the band.
It was like a very bittersweet thing because it doesn't feel the same when you have to go and present your band, you know, La Santa Cecilia, but you're missing one, like, key member.
I thought that I should quit the band because I wasn't going to be able to travel. I felt like at points I was pulling the band a little bit backwards instead of moving forward because of my situation. A un sueño despertando, mientras otro en el asfalto ya se está esfumando. It's really hard when you're trying to pursue a dream and you know that you can't follow that dream because of the lack of papers.
I know that he would feel embarrassed when people would ask, like, why, and how come you didn't go to Mexico, or how come you're not in the photos, and it doesn't seem like anything, but it's like he works just as hard as everybody else. No,
he's a part of this country. He grew up here. He came here as a child, and he's no different than me, and I was born here.
ICE, Immigration and Customs Enforcement. ICE, El Hielo. Eva pasando el trapo sobre la mesa y está
cuidando que todo brille como una perla. Writing El Hielo was a form of, like, an exhaust valve for us.
The people in the song are based on my mother, are based on our friends, are based on Pepe.
We all grew up with a certain experience with ICE or La Migra, you know, with a family member or something like that.
I think it was his way of saying, yes, I'm undocumented, and to come out.
I just thought it was time. I saw so many activists as well putting themselves out there, and that's what kind of, like, made me not be as fearful. El hielo anda suelto por esas calles. Nunca se sabe cuándo nos va a tocar. Lloran los niños, lloran a la salida. That's the way you move forward once you stop fearing whatever's out there.
And I think it helped him to feel proud and to say, hey, yeah, I'm undocumented, but it's okay. I'm going to work on it. We're going to figure it out. And I'm working with my bandmates instead of having to lie, no?
As musicians, I also feel that we have the responsibility to share our stories and hopefully make some change.
Grammy or no Grammy, it's we're in the same boat, you know?
It just gives us a bigger platform and a bigger spotlight to speak of his situation and speak of everybody's situation that's going through the same thing. And for the Academy to recognize us means that they're recognizing a positive contribution that we're making as children of immigrants or immigrants ourselves to this country and this culture.
We love Pepe, and he's someone very important in the band, no? So we figure it out. Because that's what you do with family, that's what you do with your friends, and we all want to be here and want to play music and write and fulfill our dreams, so we're all just trying, just keeping on, you know?
Okay, at this time I am approved for the deferred action, And I am also in the process of obtaining my residency after 26 years. So I'm looking forward to that, and hopefully that comes through sometime this year and I can keep on living my dream.
La Santa Cecilia's new album, Someday New, was released this week. Pepe Carlos has gotten approval from U.S. Immigration to travel to Mexico City for the music festival Vive Latino later this month. It will be his first trip back to Mexico in 26 years. In radio and theater, there's a term you might not know. It's called the voice of God. It's an anonymous voice that delivers messages or announcements to the audience. This week, sabiduría, or words of wisdom, are given to us by one such anonymous voice, voiceover actor Silvia Villagrán.
Latin America's sexiest guilty pleasure is now on Mundos.
She talked to us about what it takes to be a bilingual voice actor.
I've got an agent, but they were only sending me out on stuff in Spanish. I cornered them and I said, so I really want to know, why are you not sending me out on stuff? You know, because I'm ready. I'm willing to do it. And he goes, you know, you don't have anything special going on with your voice, so I can't really sell you. I could really let that affect me, or, which was what I did, I got pissed. And I was like, you're not going to tell me that I don't have anything special going on with my voice after A, I have work, and B, you're taking 10% of it. So I fired him, and I went looking for an agent. I went to my current agent, Sutton Barthavenari, SBV, and we came to the conclusion that maybe it would be good to change my name. They kept saying that maybe the casting directors or clients, when they hear my slate, Silvia Villagrán, they'd go, they wouldn't maybe not want to hire me. So I changed my name to Silvia Granville. I actually started getting callbacks. I got a couple jobs. And then 1999 happened. And it was J-Lo and Ricky Martin and Selma Hayek. And all of a sudden it became super sexy, right? To be Latina. And so my agent and I said, okay, let's change it back. So now I was Silvia Villagrán. And all of a sudden now I began to book. I hear this all the time. People have told me that I have a really great voice and I want to get into voiceovers. It takes a lot more than your voice.
And that's it for this week, mis queridos radio escuchas. Next week, we're coming at you live from South by Southwest. Don't miss it. It's going to be a lot of fun. So if you're in Austin, please be a part of our live studio audience. Our show is produced by AC Valdez, Lita Hartman, Daisy Rosario, Marlon Bishop, Michael Simon Johnson, Brenda Salinas, Camilo Vargas, and Nadia Raymond, our music consultant. Bienvenido to our new engineer, Cornelius McMoyler, who doubles as our Italian teacher. Ciao, Cornelius. Our interns are Daniel Gunter and Antonia Cerejido, and Nancy Trujillo makes it all happen. Special thanks this week to Allison Holm and WCBE in Columbus, Ohio, and to Mr. Bill Cosby. Our show was founded at the University of Texas at Austin. I'm your host and executive producer, Maria Hinojosa. Join us again next week, and in the meantime, you can find us on Facebook, Twitter, and Tumblr, and I'll see you on Instagram. Hasta la próxima.
Latino USA is made possible in part by the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation and the Ford Foundation, dedicated to working with visionaries on the front lines of social change worldwide.
This is my urban Mundo's voice. You're listening to Antonia Cerejido on Latino USA.
That was so cool. That was awesome.
Support for NPR comes from NPR stations and Lumber Liquidators, hardwood, bamboo, and cork flooring for the home handyman or building professional. More at lumberliquidators.com. And the Lemelson Foundation, supporting inventors and invention to improve lives in the U.S. and developing countries, on the web at lemelson.org. And by Newman's Own Foundation, giving all profits from Newman's Own to charity and pursuing the common good for over 30 years. This is NPR.